The Sacred Changemakers podcast is supported by Coaches Business School, helping the world's most caring coaches build a purpose-driven and profitable business that makes a meaningful impact in our world. Check out their unique frameworks and methods to help you transform and grow your business. Now is the time to build a bridge from what you want in life to include what the world needs. You can do well in business and do good. And together, we can make a meaningful difference. Find out more at coachesbusinessschool.com.
Hey there, and welcome back to the Sacred Changemakers podcast. Now, our guest today is CEO Mohan Sivaloganathan, also known as the Batman of Social Impact because, well, he's a nonprofit leader by day and a hip-hop artist by night. Mohan is the CEO of Our Turn, the nation's leading movement of students fighting for education justice. And above all, Mohan is a father, a husband, a son, a brother, a friend, and also, very interestingly, a troublemaker for the status quo. Now, throughout his career, Mohan has partnered with young people, professionals, and organizations to advance transformative change in the areas of education, justice reform, mental health, civic engagement, and more. Now, on the mic, he has delivered many performances and talks in partnership with the World Economic Forum, Stanford Social Innovation Review, Net Impact, NYU, Penn State, the University of San Diego, the Center for Social Innovation, DeFi Ventures, and the World in Conservation Project, and again, so many more. New York nonprofit media awarded him a 40 Under 40 Rising Star, and a next generation leader by the Human Services Council. He was also featured in Good is the New Cool, an Amazon philanthropy and charity number one new release. So I think you can tell by his multifaceted bio that this is going to be an extraordinary conversation. And indeed it is. Our conversation was inspirational and insightful. So we dive deep here into the heart of what it means to be a leader in today's world. We discuss Mohan's approach to inclusive, harmonious leadership, which suggests that embracing individuality and community is key to unlocking our collective potential. We tackle the formidable task of addressing systemic inequities, emphasizing the need to change not just the structures, but also the mental models and narratives. And we talk about the pivotal role of the CEO in driving change. Mohan also shares behind the scenes his own unique path of continuous personal growth, his experiences as an immigrant and a father, and how his roots have fueled his passionate drive for social justice. We discuss the power of troublemaking as a force for good. We talk about the sacred in life and business and the transformative possibilities when we weave music, culture, and activism into a harmonious movement for change. So get ready. Get ready to be inspired, to learn, and be a part of the conversation that connects individual stories to the grand vision of systemic transformation, as Mohan encourages us to amplify our voice for social change. Now, you're even going to get to hear some hip hop. And I think that's the first time I have ever said that in an intro. So without further ado, let me introduce you to Mohan Sivaloganathan. Hey, Mohan, welcome to the Sacred Changemakers podcast. How are you doing today, my friend?
I am doing wonderful. I want to lean into this idea of sacred. I'm feeling good. I'm feeling lifted.
What a juicy way to start. Yeah. And that's certainly a conversation that's very alive in our community, is these questions we ask of what would be different if we considered life as sacred? What would be different if we considered business as sacred? So there's just a few teasers as we go in. But, you know, our audience, they've just heard your professional bio. And I'd love to kind of get underneath the surface of that for a moment and just kind of get you to tell us something about the real life human that lies beneath that. Who is he?
Yeah, I love this question. And my reflexive mind goes towards certain verbs and adjectives and descriptors and titles. But honestly, I think the best way I could describe who I am underneath any title or bio is I'm someone who's growing. I'm growing, I'm learning, I'm discovering, I'm exploring. And that journey touches on this exploration of fatherhood, the exploration of what it means to be a man of color and an immigrant in the U.S. Who leads a national organization, who is a dad, who is striving to further unify mind, body, and spirit, and you know, through journeys of mental health and physical health and more. So I'm growing. What I'm trying to lean into, or working to lean into more and more, is that, you know, what I might be in one moment, what I might be feeling, you know, that's fluid. And I realize, like, all of this might be, I don't know, you know, sort of meta or philosophical, but that's just truly where I'm at right now at this stage in life, is someone who is just constantly growing, you know, working to get better, but not in, like, I think the traditional sense of, that I might have carried several years ago, where better might have meant greater quantitative results, more policies being passed, more accolades, but better in terms of healing, and grounding and abundance and expansiveness, greater acceptance of who I am, so that I can be able to, I think, just magnify this purpose that I have in my life. Yeah, hopefully that makes some sense.
It certainly does. And you mentioned there the purpose that you have in life. And I definitely want to dive into that. And as we do, and I get you to kind of walk us through a little bit of how you see your purpose, I'd love to hear a little bit of kind of the backstory. Like, why is this your purpose? Because I always find that fascinating, how we come to do the work that we feel is so kind of inspiring and purpose driven for us in the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to start my story always with the story of my parents. My parents were Sri Lankan immigrants, came to the United States without means, without connections, without money. You know, they weren't what you might consider to be the stereotypical successful South Asian immigrants today. You know, came for, you know, the tech industry or something like that. No, like they came with a dream. They came with just hopes, and, you know, I think leaned into probably that idea of constant growth way before I ever discovered it, because there wasn't really an endpoint. Like, there wasn't a clear linear path for them. So they had to work hard and stay true to themselves, stay true to each other, and were able to get to this point where they wanted to be immensely successful. And they did that through careers in service. My dad worked for the U.S. government. My mom was a teacher. And, like, that could have been it. And I think in many ways for them, in what they were able to set up for me and my sisters, like, then that could have been sufficient. Like, all right, you've got the platform, you've got stability, so that, you know, I could go to a great university, so that I can be able to go and work at a corporation. And all of that was true. All of that was real. But I was also just trying to just take things in, you know, throughout that journey. And a lot of times that happened in the context of frustration, that happened in the context of isolation. There were so many times where I felt like I didn't belong, where people were literally telling me I did not belong. And there was a struggle for me to be able to find my footing in classrooms, in work settings, you know, even with peers, you know, other students around me. Like, I was always trying to figure out, like, who exactly am I? Like, what is my role in all of this? And that started to get me to actually start thinking more about broader culture and systems. And I was fortunate just because of books that I came across and classes I would take, you know, when I was in college, and started learning about sociology, learning more about the civil rights movement in the U.S. And what that started to illustrate for me is that, hey, yes, everything that I'm experiencing, it's really challenging. And oftentimes it hurts. And I'm not alone in this. And that was a huge revelation for me, that I'm not alone in this, that there are so many people who feel like their identity, their story, their power is suppressed in some shape or form. And specifically in the US, you have Black and Indigenous and Brown communities and immigrant communities, low-income communities that are systematically disenfranchised. And so this has been an institutional design for a long time. And that really frustrated me. Now I started getting very angry and I wanted to do something about it. And that, you know, started turning into political advocacy, doing nonprofit volunteering, finally jumping into the nonprofit sector a few years after launching my career at Procter & Gamble. And what I discovered was that, you know, at that time I was starting to do this work around education equity and education justice. And what I discovered, or at least the light bulb that turned on for me, was that there are so many smart people out there. There are so many incredible game-changing ideas. And you know, that is the power of the human spirit, right? Is that we continue to come up with you know, these really just genius concepts and strategies and initiatives. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it comes down to the people who are actually coming up with those ideas. And my belief is that we don't really have much of an idea deficit right now when it comes to driving social justice. The deficit comes from our ability to activate people. Mm-hmm. And again, when you're in this context where so many folks feel like they're suppressed, then we're always going to have this ceiling. We're always going to be boxed in. And that's what started to then give birth to this purpose that I was able to discover and start to shape and curate and magnify. And now what fuels what I do day in, day out on the good days and the not so good days is this purpose to spark troublemaking. And to me, troublemaking, it's not just simply, hey, you should be, I think people think about agitation off the bat. It should be disruption. Yes. But really, troublemaking to me is lifting up your voice, your story, and your action to shake the status quo. And that could be a status quo in your own life. That could be a status quo within your community. It could be a status quo in your company. It could be a status quo in your country. But it starts with that person lifting just who they are, what they have to say, their experiences, their authenticity, the story of who they are as individuals, you know, similar to me being able to share my story with you today and with your community. And then being able to do something, big or small, just doing those three things, that is troublemaking. And my purpose is to put jet fuel on troublemaking and to be able to see that at a movement level, at a systems level, and to be able to see that at an individual level. I'm very much at a stage in my life now where it's not just about the forest, but it's about the trees and the forest too. Like, you know, without the trees, you don't have the forest, right? I think we're oftentimes taught, oh, just, you know, look at the forest, but no, we have to look at the people. And those individual stories, I just get so much fuel from now.
So I love this word troublemaking because, you know, it's not really a lens that we think of in a positive light normally. You know, when we think of troublemaking, we think of, and I kind of go back in my own career too, and it's a long time ago when I did work in corporate, I was always known as the maverick. Like I didn't fit in. Like I always wanted to disrupt things or change things, or just because that was the way we did things, that wasn't enough for me. Right. And so I love the reframe that you're giving this, because what you're suggesting or pointing towards here, Mahan, is this idea that troublemaking has a positive kind of energy with it. It can actually lead to good things. And at the same time, I know through, you know, working for a number of decades now at senior levels of organizations that there's also a lot of trepidation around that. There's a lot of fear about opening a can of worms, right? Do we really want to open this? Do we really want this trouble that this is going to bring? So there's something very interesting about this that is reframing it into a positive kind of energy flow, if I might say, and yet at the same time acknowledging that there's disruption with it. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I think the more that we can deeply consider our own journeys and the context in which we operate, the more we can recognize that troublemaking is positive and necessary. So a story I'll share, I was talking with a friend who's a doctor a little while back, and you know, he had just such a challenging residency experience, like so many other doctors, right. Like sacrificing sleep, sacrificing mental health, physical health, just being pulled to the absolute brink of existence And this is an experience that so many doctors know about, just how harsh that residency experience is. And I asked him, all right, if all the doctors now who maybe have gone past the residency experience, maybe they're administrators now, if everybody knows how difficult and challenging it is, and increasingly it sounds like it doesn't actually produce results. It doesn't even, like, nobody's even saying, or not many people are actually saying, it actually makes you a better doctor. Like, then why do you keep doing it? Like, why does that happen? And, you know, he said, like, you know, for himself, but also, like, you know, I mean, this is something he's been grappling with, but what he hears a lot of other folks saying and reflecting on, it's not about the efficacy of that effort. It's not that it's working. It's in many ways, because since everybody else had to do it, then that just must be the way. And so therefore every other doctor has to do it. Like, and it's like a rite of passage, right? It's a rite of passage. And, you know, maybe it's assumed that this is what breeds doctors who are able to then deal with the highest pressure circumstances. But then if you look at now, just how much of a challenge that we have to get folks to even want to go into the profession, right? And I think people are aware of situations like this and thinking about, like, why do I want to put myself through that? And so I think troublemaking in a context like that, like, is there really like a fear of like, you know, what is the type of disruption that might lead to certain tactics and strategies? Like, is it really cerebral? No, it's actually like institutionalized and deeply embedded within people that, hey, this is just how we've always done it. And so therefore we should keep doing it that way. But, you know, you look at, you know, you could look at workforce design, say in the corporate context, for instance, and, you know, it could be people who are, you know, burning themselves out, maybe not doctors, but they're burning themselves out on certain projects and certain initiatives, not spending as much time with their families, feeling like they don't have agency in what they're doing. These could be folks who are in their 40s, who are in their 50s, and they know that doesn't work. We know it's not effective, but simply because we've been indoctrinated into thinking that's how it's always supposed to be, we just wind up perpetuating the status quo. But if we can just take a moment to recognize that, hey, this is not working for me, it's not working for people around us, it's not working for the next generation, then I do believe we can open up that door to that positive troublemaking. Whereas, as the late great John Lewis used to say, the good trouble, you know, the good trouble that is needed, so that we can actually live more thriving lives, more fulfilling lives, and actually be more effective.
Yeah, I think you're speaking to something that's incredibly important here. Is this, I don't know how I'd describe it really, other than the habitual kind of way of being in daily life, in a way, and actually taking a pause and stepping back and realizing that, you know, raising our awareness to the fact that actually this, whatever the this is a problem. And I think that in modern life, we get so busy that just that stepping back, like you just described there, to just have that different perspective, to go and actually acknowledge that there's a problem, is sometimes a challenge, right? And now you talked earlier, Mahan, about the cultural difference, right? Through your early life, you know, in the US as an immigrant, through school and education and all these things. And one of the things that I think about is how pervasive culture is. And it's very hard to see when you're in it. So I just wondered if, when you look back, you know, on those early career struggles and the different challenges that you went through, especially regarding cultural differences, you know, how has that shaped, in a way, your approach? And is there anything that kind of bubbles up for you, a story perhaps, or a memory that has really kind of been like a threshold of change for you that got you to the point where there is a problem, we need to do something about it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. You know, I've been ambitious for as long as I can remember. I've wanted to be successful, you know, wanted to be someone who, you know, who I think could fit in. And I think for the purpose oftentimes of being successful, you know, to be able to lead. And, you know, I think that was just like, in many ways, that was the young me, right? And who wasn't really thinking about like real connection and harmony with myself or other people. But with that, you know, as from my very first job in my career out of P&G, I started receiving feedback formally and informally, about just how I was showing up as a person and the discomfort that people were feeling as a result. So through these many different stops in my career, I've literally been told that I'm too egotistical, too aggressive, too soft, too out there, or even literally too vanilla. That's been told to me too. You know, too robotic, too impersonal, or too like, you know, sort of like too casual, like both robotic and and casual. And the reason why I think I've received all these different labels is because I would receive one and then try to correct and then overcorrect. Right. And so for instance, it was like, yeah, you know, too casual, you know, wearing a hat to work. All right. So I started wearing business casual all the time. And then people started saying I'm too robotic and too vanilla. They couldn't read who I am. Okay, let me try and get a little bit more casual again. Oh, well, we can't really take him. We can't take him seriously, you know, and like, it would just keep going back and forth. This was happening for years. And I'm just trying to find my way. And it's, you know, you lose some of your humanity in that process, right? Like I felt like I was losing that. Like I was so driven by my purpose and I thought that should be enough, but it wasn't. And even as I was able to be successful as a part of certain strategies, projects, initiatives, like that wasn't enough. I was still this outsider. And I was really fortunate along the way that it wasn't just like, hey, I was just a kite blowing in the wind. I had, you know, just and continue to have incredible family members, incredible friends, allies, mentors who I could talk to along the way, who could help to just fill my cup back up, to affirm who I am. What is it that makes me special? What is it that makes me unique? Which then got me to this point where after I became a dad, you know, I realized, you know, like this is obviously a major life-changing moment for me. It's time for me to just take a pause. And so I did paternity leave. I took a pause from work. I stepped away from the role that I was in. And I wanted that to be a time where, number one, I could be a dad and I could just live that up. And it's the title that I'm the proudest to hold to this day. I have a five-year-old who's just abundantly remarkable. But also I took the time to consider, all right, like who am I? Like, what is it that lights me up? And then how do I want to be able to show up at work? And, you know, literally went through a process of reflection and reading and writing those things down. Like I hadn't done that really before. Like I had sort of like a leadership philosophy and ethos, but it wasn't necessarily who I am. But I was able to then harmonize that with, all right, like, what are my values and what do I want the day to day to feel like for me? And that then guided the next step in my career into this role where I'm in now as a CEO of Our Turn. And this is the first role that I've ever held where I feel like I know that I'm truly authentically me. And for better or worse, like, you know, a part of it, I'll admit, I think comes from the privilege of positional authority, you know, being a CEO, you know, you get a certain amount of room and leeway. And I've leaned into that, but also I have a remarkable team that gives me the grace and the permission to lean into who I am, and to do that through and through. You know, we have an event that we're doing tonight where, you know, we're doing this rally for, you know, a lot of our student-led coalitions who are launching these issue-based campaigns from coast to coast. I'm going to be hosting, you know, emceeing this event. And like, as a part of the presentation, like I'm infusing hip hop lyrics throughout.
Right.
And it's gonna be great. Like, and even if some people aren't really feeling hip hop, like they know that's me. And so cool. Like that's, you know, it is what it is. And I just feel so much more courage to do that now. You know, I feel courage. Like I'm not trying to prove anything or show people that I'm this or that. No, this is just me. This is me. And again, I'm fortunate to be in a space where that is embraced.
And as I'm listening to you, I'm realizing what a sad state of affairs it is that what you're describing is so unusual, where somebody can have the courage to be themselves and express themselves fully through their work and through their careers, But unfortunately, it's kind of the world we live in, isn't it? So how would you describe your vision for change, Mohan? Like, or your, I mean, maybe that's the same as your purpose, but I feel like there's all these seeds inside of you that are germinating that you would like to see come to fruition. What's alive there for you?
Yeah, you know, I'll share, you know, maybe a part of that overall vision for me, an element that, of course, relates to my work at Our Turn, mm-hmm. where, you know, the long story short is that we strive to uplift the voices and change making of young people to forge an equitable education system.
Lovely.
So looking at education, oftentimes when folks think about, like, what is the vision for the future of education? Not everybody, but many will think, all right, everyone needs to be performing on their statewide tests at level X, 100% math proficiency, 100% reading proficiency, 100% of folks have a certain type of job. Okay, sure, fair enough. I respect that. Increasingly, where I'm at is actually, what if we center on the individual students? And if we center on the individual students, all right, so for you, should it be 100% math? Actually, I don't know. Maybe it's science. Maybe it's art. You know, maybe it's public speaking. Maybe it's politics. So maybe it's math for that individual student, but maybe it's science and robotics. Maybe it's arts, poetry. Maybe it's politics. Maybe they're just 10 years old and they don't know yet, right? And we'll figure it out. So when I think about the vision for education, what I would love to see is that every young person has an individualized success plan that they have co-designed, that they are driving forward, and it is supported by an ecosystem of people, leaders, resources, institutions to ensure that success plan comes to life and it can evolve and modify and grow as needed, but it is centered on that individual. And so with that, what I believe we can do is we can unlock on agency. We can unlock creativity. We can unlock the most effective and transformative solutions. Because, like, if you were to say, for instance, all right, the solution is that it's going to be, you know, a college counselor for everybody, a math tutor for everybody, like, then we're assuming that we know the trajectory of every individual person, that we know exactly who they're supposed to be and how they're supposed to show up, when the reality is we don't. And I think about this, you know, for instance, you look at last year and the tech layoffs that happened in the US, hundreds of thousands of people who were laid off from their jobs. So you're telling me that those tech companies, those CEOs, they know what the economy is? They know the environment? They don't, because if they did, they wouldn't have had to do that. Right. They it's not that they weren't well intentioned. Like, they took their best shot, but I think it's the reflection that so many of us, we don't know what tomorrow looks like. And so if that's the case, wouldn't we be better off if every individual, so I use the education example, but let's say in the workforce, if every individual in the workforce had the agency, the support, the resources, the affirmation they need to be able to pursue their boldest ideas. To be able to drive transformative systems change, to be troublemakers, to not operate in fear. That's where I want us to be. And I think folks are hungry for that. So that's also where I hope to be able to lean in.
I love that. And you're speaking there about, you know, the changing system. So we're looking at systemic change here with that. I just wondered what other elements of systemic change you think, you know, going back to our earlier thing, that we don't always know where there's problems. I mean, what have you noticed in terms of, you know, systemic inequities and things that need to change? What are the problems that we need to be looking at, you know, from your lens right now, in addition to the education?
So I appreciate this question because it compels us to go deeper than the surface. And in the work that we do at Our Turn, but also the work that I do with systems leaders, with organizations, with individuals, as an advisor, as a consultant, as a partner, one of the frameworks that I like to use is FSG's Water as Systems Change, which quite literally pushes us to go deeper than the surface. That inverse pyramid where at the top, you're thinking about structural elements such as policies and resources, but you go down to the base of that inverse pyramid. And the thing that I want to emphasize here is mental models. Because You know, I'd say, you know, for instance, on the education side, again, you know, continue to run with this space that, of course, I have comfort and familiarity with. You know, we had a conversation within my team a few years ago where we've been doing years of policy work. A lot of that work was very effective. We were able to win a number of policies. And we had a conversation to reflect on. Let's say that every one of the policies that we care about, all of a sudden we won the campaigns on every one of those campaigns. We got exactly what we wanted. Would we have changed the fundamental issues that led to those policy changes even being necessary? And the hard reality is we recognized, no, we would not be changing those fundamental conditions. You know, maybe we drive some incremental improvement. Maybe there's some band-aids here and there, maybe like in pockets, we see some improvement. But the reality is that so many of those policies were necessary because of mental models, because of folks who believe, for instance, that not every young person will succeed, that some folks, like young people from communities of color, are not destined for greatness, who believe that it's a zero-sum game. You know, and you can just keep going with all of these different mental models that hold us back from the type of success, the type of thriving culture that we are hungry for and we all deserve. And I believe that requires several steps in order to be able to address that. I believe that we need to be investing more deeply in narrative change work, changing the actual conversations that are happening. We need to be passing the mic, because oftentimes if you want to be able to move mental models, you need to actually have proximity to different communities. You need to actually hear from, you know, for instance, young people from communities of color, understand their experiences, understand their unique value add and their power and their dynamics. And I've seen time and time again how when that happens, the adults who maybe did not have that proximity before but have it now, they walk away inspired. They walk away illuminated. So we need to be able to pass the mic more often. We need to be able to train folks around mental models. So not just like the training that automatically jumps to, hey, let's write up a strategic plan, but actually the training that helps folks to understand, like, how do you just expand the aperture for how you consider that strategic plan? Like, what are the mental models that you're carrying into this conversation that might actually restrict the type of design and collaboration that is necessary in this work? So I just think that doing that work that really touches on how people are actually like interpreting others and the space around them and how that's shaping their disposition is just so vitally critical that we get to that level of depth.
Yeah. And I'm so pleased that you've gone here. I was speaking to Jacob Trollbeck last week. He's the guy that is responsible for putting together the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals and also doing the research as to why we're not changing as quickly as we should towards them, because they're all due by 2030. And he's come up with so now the United Nations have embraced the internal development goals, which is basically the mental models. Right. And starting to realize that change begins within. And it also kind of takes us full circle back to what you were saying about, you know, it's not just about seeing the wood for the trees. It's not just about seeing the whole forest and the system, but to actually come back to the individual trees, the people that have the capacity for change within themselves that can then potentially ripple out into a much more bigger cultural, maybe systemic change. So I love that you've done that, because what it does for me as I'm listening to you, Mahan, is it puts the, let's call it the spark, the ignition for change into the hands of every single person that's listening here. Because it's very easy when we think about the challenges we're facing in the world to go, oh, well, it's systemic change. I can't change a system all by myself. But of course, there is things that each individual can do. So I love that you're kind of empowering us here to say, okay, where's your proximity? This is what I'm hearing from what you're saying. Where's your proximity? What can you do to make a difference?
Oh, 100%. I love the way you put that. I love the way you put that. And the reality is that I couldn't engage in this conversation with you around this notion about systems change and mental models at a macro level and institutions if I haven't been engaging in that discovery process for myself. And then, as I noted when we started the conversation, I'm growing. I've had to confront myself, my my own mental models that have restricted my ability to be an effective and equitable leader, you know, within my current role and beyond. I've had to confront the mental models I apply on myself, the stories that I tell about myself, and that's a long process. That's a lifelong process. I certainly do not have that solved by any stretch. But I think, you know, gaining some of those points of clarity, and then also discovering allies in that journey and realizing once again that I'm not alone. You know, I'm not the only one that has maybe had certain leadership practices that have been colonized, who have maybe held certain mental models that actually need to be dismantled, that need to be reimagined. There's just baggage that I bring to the work, just like everybody else. Right. Like that has opened the door to then similar conversations with other individuals, and which then starts to turn into conversations with cohorts of people, that starts to turn into conversations with teams, with organizations, with institutions. Right. There is the ripple effect. Right. There's a cascading effect that can happen. But yeah, I'm with you 100% on the point that if we start at the systems change level, you can't help but either be overwhelmed or try to apply one size fits all thinking. And both courses will not lead you to what you're hoping to achieve.
Right. Now, I just want to underline here that what I'm hearing you talk about, I'm going to put one of those labels on you. Hopefully this is a better one. It sounds like you have developed what I might refer to as inclusive leadership practices in your role as a CEO. And you know, this is one of the things that, you know, in certainly in my conversations with CEOs is an interesting discussion for us to have, because so many of them are trapped in who they think they should be and what they think they should be doing for stakeholders, and really aren't kind of going into the, well, who am I becoming in my role as CEO? And really what matters most here, not just for my organization, but also there's a question I like to ask, which is what's necessary, right? What does the world need from you and your leadership right now? So I just wonder, Mahan, if you could kind of share with our listeners something about how you've navigated the position of CEO, and also what you think the potential is for other CEOs who might be listening, you know, in terms of inclusive leadership and what a difference it can make through your organization, right? Whether that's a for-profit or a not-for-profit, but out into the wider world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I do like the term. I like the term inclusive leadership. I would offer up something that is increasingly speaking to me, which is this notion of harmonious leadership. And harmonious leadership to me is where you're not stuck within false choices. You're actually leaning into the power of and. You have well-being and you have impact. You're taking care of your mind and your body and your spirit. You know, the individual matters and the inclusivity and the community matters too.
Right.
And so with that, in being a CEO, it is a remarkable process. It's a remarkable journey. You know, the first thing I always tell folks who are thinking about being a CEO or executive director is that what you need to know beyond any functional skill is that you're making a choice. You do not just fall into the role of being a CEO. You are making a choice, and this is going to change who you are. It's going to change your identity. It's going to change everything, right? So from there, you know, I feel like I could just talk about this notion of like, what does it mean to be a CEO? Like my learnings on that forever. But there are two things that I would call out. You know, one is, so the way that I grew up and what I had to be increasingly conscious of, and again, these are sort of like the mental models, right? That sometimes we need to confront, we need to unpack, was how much I was influenced by alpha males. My dad in many ways was an alpha male. First hero I ever had. Continue to idolize my dad and learn from him, even though he passed about coming up on 3 years ago. I'm still learning from him and about him. You know, my dad, Malcolm X, Kobe Bryant. Like, you know, I think about Kobe. I'm a huge basketball guy. And he would talk about this notion, like, you know, as a leader, quote unquote leader for his team, like, you know, he needed to imprint his DNA on the team. And I think that's an idea that so many alpha male people in leadership positions, like, they bring forward. It's like, oh, okay, like, I am going to pull this group in this image of what I believe success looks like, because, like, I got to this point, therefore everybody should be doing what I'm doing. And I had to like, just, you know, I think suspend a lot of that thinking, reimagine a lot of that thinking very quickly. Because I think what I realized, for one, is that, yeah, maybe some of the stuff that worked for me back in maybe even 2010 is not going to work in 2020. Like, the world is rapidly evolving and changing. You have a different generation of workforce. Also, if you're in a true leadership position, what you recognize is you're not the one who's actually doing the work day to day. Like, you know, the heart of the work and the organization, you know, you're talking about the associate level folks, you know, the supervisors, the caseworkers, the teachers, right? Like, those are the folks who are getting it done day to day. And so really, like, what I need to be discovering is the harmony between what I can bring to the table and what you bring to the table. Like, what can I learn from you? And, like, how can I ensure you're in a position where you're able to thrive? And, you know, like, there can be full trust between us, like, and as opposed to me having to show up and be looking over your shoulder every day. Like, nobody wants that. I don't want that. The folks who are out there doing the work, they don't want that. But why is it that so many folks in leadership positions believe that's necessary, that everybody needs to be doing what they're doing? Like, that's how you slow down the rate of change. That's how you restrict access to the best ideas. That's how you have burnout. That's how you have attrition, right? That's the formula for it. And so you need to be able to unlock, you know, what your entire team is capable of doing. You need to unlock that power that they have in them, so that they can, again, so they can be able to design and maximize and pursue those bold and ambitious and audacious ideas. The other thing I think about as a CEO is that what I do have some role over, some control over, and this is something, again, that I talk to other leaders about often, when I'm in a context where I can be a coach or a mentor, help in training, is thinking about speed. That is something that I really embrace as a part of my role, is speed. Trying to identify the places where I might need to lean in to speed something up or to slow something down. And what I consider in those contexts are values as an organization. I consider our strategy, what are our priorities, who are the people, where are they in their trajectories as leaders within the organization, or just leaders in their own lives. And so speed is something that's really critical for me to influence. So it's, again, not so much of, hey, I need to influence you to be more like me and you to be doing X, Y, Z. Like, sometimes if we're getting to that level, then it's actually a different level of performance conversation that needs to happen. But it's actually influencing, hey, given all the circumstances now, this thing that we were talking about, we probably need to make that faster. Or this thing that we're talking about right now, hey, we actually need to slow that down. So those are just, yeah, again, a couple of considerations on the topic that I feel like I could riff on for a really long time.
I'm great. And I really appreciate you sharing that with us. Now, we've been talking about what's sometimes been said to me as, like, the serious side of change, like leadership and systems design and organizations and, you know, and all of these things, right? But I know that you have another side through hip hop and music. And I'd love to kind of play around with that for a minute and say, you know, very often when we think about the changes our world needs, we think that they've got to be serious, right? But I know that you use music as a tool for change. So tell us about that.
Absolutely. Well, you know, one thing I would just quickly note is what would it look like if we were to actually challenge the notion that something like strategic planning and systems change has to be serious?
Yeah.
Like, what would it look like if that was actually joyful? Like, what would be happening?
Right.
How would we feel? Maybe we could put a pin in that, you know? So I just, but, you know, when it comes to music, so I talked earlier about how so many labels have been thrown at me throughout the years, how, you know, when I was much younger, going back to elementary school, I was always trying to figure out who I am and where I belong. But something that was always able to give me an emotional lift, an energetic lift, and give me words and clarity and action, it was music. And then more and more, as I was growing up, it was hip hop music. Like, hip hop was just always able to tap this part of my soul when I was moving around and when I might be struggling. And even literally to this day, Like if I just feel like I just need a certain level, like emotional regulation, like music is oftentimes the first thing that I come to. And I'd been, when I was in high school, going into college, graduating, I started writing music, started performing and doing it at shows, and just really enjoyed it. Like it was really creating this positive energy in me. But then I started thinking, hey, like, I'm embarking on this social justice journey, and I want to be able to reach more people. I want to be bolder. I want to be louder. How can I do that? And started considering, like, well, what if my music could actually be that force? Like, because what I was doing at that time was, I was actually compartmentalizing my identity. Like everybody at work, I did not talk to them about my music world. And then when I was doing music, when I was on the stage, let's say, or when I was performing, like I wasn't talking about my work. I wasn't talking about the social justice side. I thought, what if I actually harmonized the two? Harmony, again, the word I keep coming back to. And that kind of gave rise to this idea of troublemaker hip hop, where I could be writing and performing music that is intended to be able to, again, like lift positive energy, to be able to lift voices, to be able to inspire folks to take action, to do that in community. Not only has that been something that has been so remarkably powerful and just catalytic for me and bringing me to so many different spaces across the world that I never could have imagined. I've performed at the World Economic Forum. I performed at a prison once. I performed at the New York Bar Association. I performed at traditional music venues and poetry cafes. But also, I think what we all know is that we have to activate both sides of our brain. And the most resilient and I think the successful movements for generations have been ones where art and culture have been a central part of that movement. Film, music, poetry, visual arts, and more. So I just believe that music is essential in this work that we do. It touches the heart, it builds connection. It can be that thing that at a conference can wake you up, right? It could be that thing in the car that can wake you up. I've just even like these like little instances where I just know that it's real and it's true. Sometimes I'll receive like a message from a friend who maybe I haven't heard from in months, and will say that, hey, like, I've been listening to your music in the car on the way to work, and it's like it's been giving me a lot of energy. Or someone else who will say, like, yeah, I've been listening to your stuff, like, while I've been going out on jogs, and here's what it's been doing for me. That's when I know, yeah, like, it's not just about like my music, it's about the power of music. It's about the power of culture and how central it is to these movements that we're trying to build.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I wonder, I'm putting you on the spot a little bit here, but could you give us a taster of what you mean by using music in this way, by using your voice and sharing something with us?
But yeah, absolutely. So I'll share a verse actually from a song called Love Letter, which I released last year, and just very fortunate, it was actually named as an honorable mention in the USA Songwriting Competition last year. So I think a song like this, through the power of hip hop, I think to be recognized in that way, and I feel like it's just more evidence in the power of music. So with that, it's true we made a breakthrough. The pressure of a living in all the activism, it could break you, but we can break rules. Not only for the system, but even my condition, it can make you. My vision is we multiply, no division, no prisoners, only looking fly, no stripes, no position is how they shake you. We rise against vampires, push a stake through. This is love ledger. This is a love letter to the legends above us. We thank you in numbers. You got us out of the gutters, crushed linen, so butter while calling shots and discussions. When it's all said and done, I hope we discover the justice you wanted for us, and you're proud of how we done it. I'm the son, you're the fathers and mothers.
Wow. I love how that lands in such a different way to the rest of our conversation. It's like it hits my brain in a different way, and I feel it's got the potential to reach very different groups of people than, that's the leaders or the people in power to really catalyze a movement here, Mahan.
Yeah, that's the hope. That's the hope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love it. I do. So, what does the future hold for you?
Yeah, it's great timing, for that question. I'm actually, so I'm stepping down from my role at our turn. So that's the, boom, I don't know, mic drop or whatever it might be. It's been an incredible journey, 5 years in this role. I feel very privileged, very grateful that what I hope to be able to achieve in this role, I feel like we've gotten it done in many ways, and the organization's absolutely set up for success going forward. So I'm so excited. Like, I'm unbelievably excited for the organization. And then for me, there's discovery and growth. And I appreciate this conversation, because much of what I've been talking about, the notion of harmonious leadership, is what I want to be able to breathe more life into, out into the field. And so with that, I'm starting to venture into this world of consulting and, working with organizations and leaders to be able to help them to design, game-changing solutions that lean into the power of harmonious leadership. Coaching, something else, both from the individual and cohort-based standpoint, and then building from the bars that I just dropped there. Just you creating. I want to be doing more creating. That's music, that's film. Writing is something that I'm considering too, but also helping others to be able to create more often. So consulting, coaching, and creating, that's where my mind is at right now. And, welcome conversations with anybody who might want to learn more.
I love that. And it sounds, we opened this with you saying you were really interested in this word sacred, right? That sounds to me like a sacred calling. It feels like you're being called into a movement, like the thing you can't not do, the thing that is kind of calling to you to express yourself fully in the world and bring forward the changes that matter most.
Absolutely. I think that's 100% real. I think it's in many ways been this this exploration of what is my body telling me? What's my mind telling me? What's the universe telling me? And yes, this isn't necessarily where I envisioned landing even a year ago when I started thinking that, hey, it was about time for me to step down from my role. But being open to those different inputs, those different signals and messages, both direct and indirect, have very, very much put me in this, what feels like a sacred place.
Love that. Okay, Mohan, well, I'm noticing the time here. So I just want to ask you a final question. If there's something that you would like to have shared with our audience today, perhaps we didn't have time to get to it, or maybe it's just some words of wisdom to leave everyone with, what might it be?
The words of wisdom I would offer are, I think in some ways inspired by what I might share with my son. And increasingly what I'm realizing is that I need to follow my own advice. So this is wisdom both to, to myself and to everyone out there. Which is that you are special as you are. It's real and it's true. We say it to our kids, right? We say it to people we love. What would it look like if we just embrace that for ourselves? We don't have to be chasing. We don't need to be following somebody else's archetype. We don't need to be beating ourselves up with negative stories, spiraling stories. We don't need to, nor should we. There is something much more beautiful and abundant if we just embrace the magic of who we are.
As I'm feeling into that, I'm just realizing that if we could do that for ourselves, then of course, that's the path to also holding that space for others. Mm-hmm. So I really love that. Thank you, Mohan. Thank you so much for stopping by today. I've really enjoyed our conversation. I know our listeners will be taking so much away. So thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Okay, guys, that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for listening in. Now, before we go, I want to remind you that all of the resources and the links for our guests are in the show notes at sacredchangemakers.com. A big thank you to the members of the Sacred Changemakers Inner Circle, who are our podcast sponsors, and also our extended community, who are helping us to make a global impact aligned with the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, all visible on our website. And if you're looking for maybe a little more soul in your life and business, if you have a sense that you too have a calling, maybe you're here to make a bigger impact or simply connect with others on your change-making journey. If our episode resonated with you today, I hope you'll consider joining us. Again, you can find out more at sacredchangemakers.com. But for now, I just want to say thank you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your intention and efforts to make our world a better place. Until next time. Lots of love.